sweltering heat grips parts of the world with temperatures on track to set all-time records.
While Europe grapples with a heat wave, as many as 61,000 people may have died in sweltering heat on the continent just last summer, according to a recent estimate posted in the journal Nature.
Plus, U.S. and Association of Southeast Asian Nations leaders again raise concerns over the Myanmar junta's bloody crackdown on pro-democracy opponents.
As the military regime in Myanmar continues to commit atrocities and undermine regional stability, there was broad support in today's meetings for continuing to press the regime to end the violence.
And the popular educational career path Afghan men and women are steering away from now that the Taliban are back in control. Today is Monday, July 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Climate scientists say recent weeks have been the hottest worldwide and likely the hottest in the past 100,000 years. Italy issued red alerts for 16 cities on Sunday as meteorologists warn temperatures will hit record highs across southern Europe in the coming days. As parts of the world face sweltering heat, others are underwater. And as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, for some oceanside tourist destinations, the effects of climate change threaten both their existence and way of life.
A roaring wildfire charred forests and homes on the Spanish island of La Palma as gusts of wind helped fan the flames. Authorities there say in India's capital, record rainfall plunged roadways underwater. New Delhi is in its typical monsoon season but has seen an atypical rainfall nearly 10 times what's expected for this time of year. In the northeastern United States, heavy rains washed away roads, forced evacuations, and grounded airplanes. The storms hit parts of New England, New York, and Connecticut, with some areas reporting rainfall north of 10 centimeters. It is against this backdrop that we go underwater on the coast of Florida, where scientists say extreme temperatures wreak havoc on coral reefs and entire marine ecosystems.
In addition to having extremely high temperatures on land, we're also having really high sea temperatures. And so some of our long-term monitoring sites here off of Miami are starting to show signs of early coral bleaching. So they're starting to pale and losing their their algal pigments, and eventually we expect them to bleach fully.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, describes coral bleaching as coral expelling its symbiotic algae amid external stressors like change in water temperature. NOAA says in 2005, the U.S. lost half of its Caribbean reefs in 1 year due to bleaching. But the scientists working on a project to restore the reef say they see signs of hope in an unlikely place, along the waterways where giant cruise ships line up at a terminal.
So we're deep inside the port right now, and it's generally extremely turbid, warm, water sits here for a long time, so not what we would think to be a pristine coral reef habitat. But along this stabilized shoreline here where we have riprap or large boulders, we have corals that have settled and are thriving. These corals are some of the healthiest that I have seen all over Miami, and they grow incredibly large and seem to be healthy.
Scientists say this new technique of breeding and transplanting healthy coral could be the key to supporting their viability before reintroducing them into the ocean. Experts say coral reefs create homes for millions of species, encourage healthy marine food webs, and protect coastlines. They are also a tourist attraction that supports local economies in America's Sunshine State. NOAA recently reported Florida water temperatures of 35 degrees Celsius compared to what has typically ranged between 22 to 31 degrees Celsius. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Despite not advancing on its goal to join NATO, Ukraine did receive security assurances by the military alliance's members during their summit last week in Vilnius. And as VOA's Veronica Balderas-Inglesias reports, the Biden administration emphasized this Sunday that its support for Kyiv remains strong.
Ukrainian forces released more footage Thursday of efforts to defend their territory from Russia's attacks. The question of whether the war has reached a stalemate was raised to White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan during his appearance on the ABC News Network.
You're seeing Ukrainian forces, in fact, make progress both in the east and the south. We said before this counteroffensive started that it'd be hard going, and it's been hard going. That's the nature of war, but the Ukrainians are continuing to move forward.
As Sullivan emphasized the Biden administration's commitment to provide Ukraine with the weapons it needs, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, who is visiting India, talked about other measures being taken to weaken Russia's belligerence.
We will also continue to cut off Russia's access to military equipment and technologies that it needs to wage war against Ukraine. One of our core goals this year is to combat Russia's efforts to evade our sanctions.
During the recent summit in Vilnius, NATO members stood by Kyiv despite not offering it a clear roadmap to join the alliance.
But let's not underestimate what the Ukrainians did get out of this. First, they got the continued endorsement of support through commitment to long-term security assistance, the provision of military equipment and ammunition.
But for that support to remain strong, NATO members must step up their financial contributions, said Republican Senator Dan Sullivan on NBC.
It's undermined the sustainability of NATO when only 7 of 31 members of NATO currently meet their 2% of GDP obligation for defense spending. And look, that, in my view, has the potential to undermine even support for Ukraine in the near term and longer term, the support for NATO.
U.S. President Joe Biden, however, made it clear last week that Ukraine won't need to wait for NATO membership to receive long-term security assurances. He was referring to a new framework unveiled by the group of 7 of the world's most advanced economies that paves the way to address Kyiv's current and post-war needs. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin said in an interview published Sunday that Russia has a significant stockpile of cluster munitions and warned that it reserves the right to take reciprocal action if Ukraine uses the controversial weapons. The comments were Putin's first on the delivery of cluster munitions to Ukraine from the U.S. Foreign ministers of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, again condemned the ongoing violence in Myanmar, triggered by the military junta's bloody crackdown on pro-democracy opponents. At a summit in Jakarta, Indonesia, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sought support within the alliance to counter China's support for the junta and Beijing's aggression in the South China Sea. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
At an ASEAN gathering in Jakarta, Indonesia, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken stressed that the United States shares with ASEAN members the vision of a free, open, prosperous, secure, interconnected, and resilient Indo-Pacific region. But ASEAN member Myanmar has been barred from the group's meetings because of the junta's failure to honor a 2-year-old deal to halt the violence triggered by the 2021 military coup. Blinken had this to say about the problems caused by Myanmar and North Korea.
As the military regime in Myanmar continues to commit atrocities and undermine regional stability, there was broad support for continuing to press the regime to end the violence and to fulfill its commitments under ASEAN's 5-point consensus. The DPRK's unlawful weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs, including its latest ballistic missile launch just this week, also threaten the region and the global non-proliferation regime.
Experts say the Myanmar crisis has tested ASEAN's unity, with maritime members more likely to take a tough stance with the junta than mainland members such as Thailand. One expert told VOA that China had pushed its mainland neighbors hard to engage with and accept Myanmar's military junta. Jason Tower is the country director for Myanmar with the United States Institute of Peace. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
I think a big role here is the level of influence that China has with a lot of the neighboring countries and its push to try to bring the military much more back into the fold and to push for neighboring countries to follow its own steps in giving the military political legitimacy, engaging with the military, doing business with the military, and so on.
Blinken said he had a candid and constructive conversation with China's top diplomat, Wang Yi, on a range of issues, including Russia's war of aggression against Ukraine and cross-Taiwan Strait relations. But the top U.S. diplomat had this to say about his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov.
I think it's fair to say that based on what we heard from Foreign Minister Lavrov today, his interventions and engagements were not constructive or productive on any issue. He focused, unlike the United States and unlike many other countries, on a totally negative presentation and agenda in which he effectively ascribed every problem in the world to the United States.
Blinken said there was no indication that Russia is willing to engage in meaningful diplomacy to end its unprovoked war in Ukraine. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Regional authorities say a Mexican journalist was shot dead in a store parking lot on Saturday in the southern tourist town of Acapulco, the country's second journalist to be killed in a week. A Palestinian gunman opened fire on a car in the occupied West Bank Sunday, wounding three Israelis, including two girls, before fleeing, according to Israeli authorities. At least 37 people have died since days of heavy rain started pounding South Korea's central regions, triggering flash floods and landslides and destroying homes across the country. And striking screen actors began picketing alongside writers in New York and Los Angeles Friday in what has become the biggest Hollywood labor fight in decades. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists has found that the color of the ocean has significantly changed over the last 20 years. They add that this is likely due to human-produced climate change. The team, made up of U.S. and U.K. researchers, detail their findings in a study published in the journal Nature. The team proposes that tropical regions of the ocean have been getting greener over the years. The researchers say that while the color change may not be as noticeable to human eyes, the shift nonetheless has affected over 56% of the world's oceans, which they say is an area larger than Earth's entire landmass. Study authors suggest that changes in color show that marine ecosystems at the ocean's surface must also be changing, since ocean color is an actual reflection of the organisms and materials contained within its waters. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Uganda's president is blaming poor intelligence gathering for the army's struggle to stop rebels from the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. He blames members of the Allied Democratic Forces rebel group for a June attack on a school that killed 41 people. Some analysts say the solution might be dialogue and not military force. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala, Uganda.
In a security address to Ugandans Thursday, President Yoweri Museveni admitted that his army continues to face attacks by the Democratic Republic of Congo, best allied Democratic Forces rebel group, because of weak intelligence gathering. Museveni assured Ugandans that the ADF has been wiped out, saying its members have operated as individuals instead of a group since 2007. He says the Uganda People's Defense Forces have the military capability to fight the ADF, but the ADF was allowed to regroup and grow by the previous DRC leadership.
The Congo government of His Excellency Kabila, supported by some regional and international actors, gave them free tenancy in North Kivu and Ituri. They were mining gold, selling timber, harvesting people's cocoa, collecting taxes, extorting money from people, etc.
Museveni says the rebels connected with other terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. The other challenge Museveni cites is the DRC leadership at the time. He says in recent years, Uganda has built an anti-terrorism capacity that ensures the rebels won't take power or control any part of Uganda. He said the ADF was defeated within Ugandan territory in 2007, but continues to operate in the neighboring DRC. He says since then, the ADF has planted 34 bombs. Museveni presented grisly photos of victims of the ADF that included the dismembered bodies of children. He says the remaining challenge is a lack of information, since DRC President Felix Tshisekedi has allowed the UPDF to enter Congo and fight the ADF.
They become an intelligence problem, because those who are able to defeat them, like UPDF, need to know where they are in Congo and what they are planning.
Museveni added that some people have suggested he close the border with the DRC. Such a move would be costly, since Uganda earns millions of dollars in border trade revenue. Museveni's address comes almost 1 month after the ADF entered the Lubiriha Secondary School near the Mpondwe border crossing with the DRC. 41 people were killed, 38 students were among the victims. Security analyst Solomon Asimwe of Nkumba University says it is time for the Ugandan government to look at other ways to neutralize the ADF. Museveni says the country's young people need to be empowered and their lives need to get out of poverty instead of being manipulated by the ADF. The Ugandan Security Council, chaired by Museveni, is expected to meet to discuss options on ending ADF attacks. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
Journalism, once a popular career path for young Afghan men and women, is losing its appeal for new students as the Taliban ban women from higher education and the country's media work in an increasingly restrictive environment. For VOA, Shaista Sada Lami has the story.
Just a few years ago, this journalism school in Herat was filled with students keen to pursue a career in one of Afghanistan's most vibrant sectors. But now, Kahkashan-e Sharq University is struggling to find young Afghans interested in signing up to media classes. It's a trend seen across the province and country, as restrictions on how media can operate and rules barring women from higher education turn students away.
Unfortunately, the Department of Journalism in our university and one or two other universities had too few students. Therefore, classes were cancelled.
Students taking their first step into media work say restrictions and a poor media economy can be off-putting.
Most female reporters or young people who wanted to start journalism are no longer interested because of the restrictions on media and the worsening economic situation.
Before the Taliban takeover, Herat had a varied media scene with around 70 web and print outlets. But media associations say that figure is dwindling. The Taliban have dismissed concerns about the state of journalism. Their director of information and culture in Herat says that his directorate is trying to help media.
We are trying to solve the problems of the media outlets by consulting with them regarding access to information and their financial problems.
But others question whether the industry will be able to carry on.
No one wants to pursue journalism as they don't see a future in it. If they saw a future in it, then they would study journalism and work in media.
With fewer journalism students at universities, at media companies downsizing or shuttering, audiences in Herat and elsewhere in Afghanistan will have fewer sources for news. For VOA News,
There have been some widely publicized efforts to ban books from some school districts across the U.S. The free speech organization PEN America monitors these and says that laws have been enacted in some states to restrict books that can be provided to minors. But these new laws are being challenged. Karina Bafrajian has the story.
In June 2023, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a law banning what it called sexually explicit, pervasively vulgar, or educationally unsuitable books from schools. The law will require the state to set up a new rating system for books in public school libraries. He says there is imagery and material in some library books that is just not right for kids. A similar law in Arkansas comes into effect in August. Librarians could face criminal charges if they're found to have violated the law. The Arkansas Library Association has already filed a lawsuit to stop the law's implementation. Carol Coffey from the Arkansas Library Association says the law is very vaguely worded and thus it's unclear how to follow it.
They keep talking about sexually explicit materials. Some of the books that have been mentioned by title are things like a book called It's Perfectly Normal by Roby Harris. That is a sex education book. It is intended to help parents teach their children. Different people have different ideas about what's appropriate and inappropriate, which again is part of the problem.
Texas and Arkansas aren't alone. Experts like Nadine Johnson from the free speech nonprofit PEN America say the Texas and Arkansas laws are part of a trend.
Over the past couple of years, PEN America has been tracking what's happening with respect to book bans all across the country. And we have found that at least 32 states have been affected by bans.
PEN America found that books that most often come under scrutiny raise issues of sexuality, race, and gender, and age suitability. Critics say the bans are weighted toward removing material that speaks to the LGBTQ community. Johnson says these targeted bans are illegal and they can negatively affect children and teenagers and American society.
What we are seeing now is government-mandated censorship of material, and that should be worrisome for anyone, irrespective of their political viewpoints or ideology, because the last thing we need is to have the government coming in and saying what we can and cannot have access to. That is in violation of our constitutional rights.
Americans in general don't much like the idea of government-mandated book bans either. A poll released in June by National Public Radio found that an overwhelming 69% of Americans oppose state laws that ban certain books from school libraries. The Biden White House has called them censorship, and in an unusual move, Illinois Governor J. Robert Pritzker signed a law banning book bans. The state law will strip government funding from libraries and schools that withdraw and ban certain books. Karina Bafrajian for VOA News, Washington.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thanks so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Take care and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Iranian authorities have demonstrated once again they fear the Iranian people. Prominent Iranian rapper Tumaj Solahi has been sentenced to 6 years and 3 months in prison because of his participation in the widespread peaceful anti-regime protests that spread throughout Iran last autumn after the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, arrested for improperly wearing her hijab. Tens of thousands of people were arrested during the violent crackdown by the regime over the protests. 500 people were killed and 7 were executed. Tumaj Solahi, who was 32 years old, was arrested in October and spent months in solitary confinement after he posted songs and videos supporting the protests. In one video with more than 450,000 views on YouTube, he rapped, "Someone's crime was dancing with her hair in the wind." After his arrest, Iranian state media released a video of Solahi blindfolded and bruised, apologizing for his quote-unquote mistakes. As the most recent U.S. State Department annual report on human rights in Iran made clear, Iranian courts regularly considered as evidence confessions often extracted through coercion or torture. Salehi was charged with a myriad of crimes and found guilty of incitement to violence, corruption on earth, and spreading propaganda. He was acquitted on charges of cooperating with a hostile government and insulting the supreme leader. U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller called the verdict and prison sentence for Tumaj Salehi disturbing and said the United States continues to monitor his condition. He has been consistently denied access to legal representation. His trial was held behind closed doors following reports in April he was in urgent need of medical attention after he was tortured while in detention, spokesperson Miller noted. The regime's harsh treatment in this matter is deeply troubling and must be brought to an end, and we would call on the Iranian authorities to release him and all political prisoners. The world is watching and will continue to coordinate with our allies and partners to hold Iranian authorities accountable for their human rights abuses.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.